This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us. It's Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, on today's show. It's all about parenting, education, children's health. Parental alienation is a form of manipulation. We were speaking to an expert in counselling about what this can look like in real life and can you ever build bridges and change perceptions? Parental burnout seems to be happening across Dubai and indeed the world. In conversation with a coach around recognising the signs and ultimately putting in some coping mechanisms, some techniques to help you overcome and maybe even prevent burnout. And as we go back to school and nursery, sensory processing disorder, talking sensory play and what nurseries and schools can be doing with parents to help children with that diagnosis. And from little tots to teens and beyond. Next steps after university. One young woman on the brink of her professional career joined us in the studio to talk about being a student during COVID and what her next steps are going to be.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So on Thursdays, we do talk children's education. We talk parenting, health as well. And we're talking family dynamics today. Now, couples, we know that it can be very, very tricky when there are relationship issues. And we're talking about parental alienation today. It's a form of manipulation wherein a parent uses a child or children in a fight to fight their battles. Perhaps they're pouring poison into the ear, to use an old-fashioned term. So to discuss this is child development expert and the managing director of Enliven Counselling Centre, Fatima Abdullah, is with us this afternoon. When I first heard about this, and I have to say it was a couple of years ago because in the UK it's been used in divorce courts, I found it quite a difficult concept to get my head around. But in honesty, the more you read about it and you hear about it, you more start to think of examples and identify it in perhaps people around you, hopefully not in your own life. So Fatima, thank you for being with us. We've had a number of questions on this topic as well. Can you explain in your words what you believe parental alienation to be? Can you break it down for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Helen, first of all, thank you so much for having me. Parental alienation, like you said, it's a term which has been coined and lots of people have either heard of it, also seems very far from home. But like the words that you used, it's a term of manipulation where parents indoctrinate children. Now, this can be done either intentionally or unintentionally. Okay. Most people think, oh, you know, in divorce cases, it means where an example would be a parent would, you know, they would be crying. A child would come in and would say, mommy or daddy, are you okay? And the parent would say, no, your mom or your dad said something horrible. They called me this. They said that they want me to leave the house. They said that they are going to cut the electricity. Most horrible things that is between parents that should remain between parents and not shared with children.
Things that children should not hear. And this is often what I'm kind of keen to explore is when and why this happens. So the example you just used there is, you know, with families living together under one roof. I think of this being, as I mentioned earlier, kind of divorce cases. But do you see that this happening between couples who are married and currently together, but clearly not very happy?
Yes, most definitely. That's where it would be unintentional. Or I would say that it would come down to emotional immaturity from parents. Mm. It's, you know, there's this where they always say, your child should be you should be your child's best friend. And then I think that, you know, some people take it as it's a 360. I'm my child's best friend and my child's my best friend, but it doesn't work that way. So we become too complacent with sharing everything with our children because we expect them to share everything with us.
So it becomes a boundary thing.
Yeah.
So first of all, can I just say, and this is a completely personal thing, I find anyone that thinks that their kid is their best friend is just a bit weird. Like, get some mates.
Absolutely. 100%. Absolutely.
I went to university with a girl and she was like, oh, my mum's my best friend. I tell her everything. I was like, oh, crikey, my mum wouldn't want to know everything. But when we're talking about younger children in particular, it's our duty as parents to protect them and to be appropriate with them. we should have our friends that we can rant to about our partners, and to have those little, you know, oh, you never guess what he or she did. And, you know, whether it's an offhand annoyance or something that is deeply upsetting and might lead to separation. That's not for our children to hear.
Absolutely. And Helen, something comes to mind when you said we need mates when we talk to our own friends. We're talking to somebody on the same level of mental cognition. Mm-hmm. So we're speaking to somebody who's in their 20s, somebody who's in their teens, somebody, if you're an adult, who's in their 40s. Now, when we adults past 25, the developmental stage of the brain is already completed. But remember, when you're talking to your kids under the age of 25, their cognitive processes is not, their brain is not fully developed. So for them to be able to process the information that you're telling them and the way that you're telling it to them, there's a massive discrepancy between that.
And this can be so, so damaging to obviously relationships. And a message here saying, I've got a 30-year-old daughter I haven't seen since 2004 due to parental alienation. That's just heartbreaking. I mean, it is, it's, you know, fracturing families. And also the impact on the child. Surely that must impact their trust issues, their, you know, future relationships. What have you seen and heard about on this in this respect?
This is the reason why it's making its way into court, because of the impact, short-term and long-term impact and effects on the child. So short-term impact in school, they're unable to concentrate, they lower their grades, lack of self-confidence, lack of self-esteem, self-hate, self-harm. All of these things have been attributed to parental alienation. Because it's ideally parental alienation as a guilt and shame attached, because I love this parent, I want to love them, I should love them, but I can't love them because loving them feels so wrong. So they don't trust people, and when they get into relationships, it's toxic relationships. And that follows through within their adult years.
I just wanted to put this question to you, which I think is a really interesting clarification. No name on this message, and if you're getting in touch on any topics, please feel free to be anonymous if you prefer. Saying, isn't it normal to show kids that couples fight? And that's normal. Otherwise, they'll have unrealistic expectations from relations. And I think that is totally, totally valid. We, you know, we want our kids to know that we're not these infallible beings with perfect relationships. But it's one thing to show a disagreement and hopefully a resolution, so they understand that that's, you know, hopefully what will happen. It's another thing, I think, to be saying, you know, your mother is an evil woman and she shouldn't have access to you, or you'll never guess what your father did. He is, you know, he is cruel and I don't want to be with him and I can't believe I ever loved him.
Like, yes.
That to my mind is the distinction. Would you have anything to clarify on that?
Precisely. You've said it so aptly. I mean, there's a difference between your child asking, is everything okay, when they hear you screaming, and you replying, like, you know, said, is that adults sometimes fight and there's no details. It's his fault, or it's he said something to me. You're not putting guilt on shame. You're not leaving an image in the child of your mind against another parent. Mm-hmm. The child walks away saying, I got information, but it was unbiased.
Mm-hmm. I've been a little bit overwhelmed, to be honest, Fatima, by the number of messages we've had on the topic of parental alienation, something I really wasn't that familiar with. I've heard about it in articles relating to divorce courts in the UK, but this is a form of manipulation that often comes up during separation or divorce, where a parent will perhaps try and turn the children against the other, saying truths or untruths that may or may not be appropriate for children to hear, but ultimately something that isn't with anyone's best interests at heart. You mentioned the words emotional immaturity earlier. So I think that's a really interesting point. How can this play out in a family dynamic? What have you seen with kids here, or indeed family dynamics, when one parent is really motivated to have their own way and use this as a means of getting it?
Exactly. And the word that you use, means of getting it, because they use the children as a means of getting revenge. So they use the children, for example, you know, parents might tell children, you know, if in the scenario, I've seen some cases where they divorced and they're not living in the same house. If you choose to spend this weekend with your father, or you choose to spend, or you choose to go ahead with this, then I'm not going to buy you this something. So that's pure manipulation. They're instilling fear and they're inciting hate, and the child will just obey, because this goes in with behavioral psychology. So if you do this, there's a punishment. Mm-hmm. However, if you don't do this, or if you listen to me, or you stay with me, I'll buy you something nice. So there's reward if I listen to my mom, if I don't listen to, or dead, and there's punishment. So they are following through. So this is actually like classical conditioning for children. Mm-hmm. The other thing is where they do it unintentionally at home and they use children. Tell your dad, look at your dad. You know, he doesn't even leave anything whenever he travels. He always does this. So they are indoctrinating children with this narrative. So when they see the father, they don't, or mother, they don't want to hug them. They don't want to run and embrace them because now they've got this shame and guilt that if I'm going to love you after whatever mom or dad has said about you, now that puts me in a difficult predicament, and they will start to speak to parents in a negative way. I find lots of parents coming to me extremely hurt about things that their children have said to them.
Because presumably trying to rebuild or repair that relationship and change that narrative, change that perspective is incredibly difficult once that seed has been planted. And we had a message earlier through social media, actually, Fatima, saying, currently separated with teenagers, both kids know about an affair that their dad has had. I'm aware he thinks I'm turning the kids against them, but I'm trying to be honest with them as he refuses to address this properly. I think he's incapable of talking to them, wrapped up in guilt and self-denial. He refuses to talk about the future or haven't talked about divorce. They're teenagers. I can't hide the facts. I haven't given them all the details, but how on earth can I be positive about their father when he's behaving so abominably? One of the kids won't talk to him anyway, and there's nothing I can do about that. I'm just not sure how to navigate this. And that's what I find really, that's being completely honest. And if I'm, you know, putting my honest hat on about me being emotionally mature, if my husband had done this, it would take a lot of willpower not to be like, your dad is a dirty dog. and that's because I think I'd be searching for validation. I'd be searching for justice in a way. And I think to be able to create those boundaries and say, do you know what, I'm going to be the bigger person here. I'm going to get a counsellor to talk to about this. I'm going to talk to my friends about this. But how can you help your kids understand the situation without, I mean, the dad sounds like he thinks the mum's bad-mouthing.
Exactly. And this is the thing about parental alienation, you know. Not all parents are deliberately doing it. Not all parents has this intent to turn the children against the partner. For example, like just like how you said, you know, this is what you'd say. Mm-hmm. You would say, you know what, he's an awful...
I mean, I'd hope I wouldn't, but I'd really want to.
I know, and it's difficult to take the high road and just say, well, I'm going to think about this, and I want to think about how I want to deal with it in a mature way that's not going to affect the children now and later. But that's the thing, though. It takes discipline. And it's more of a conscious decision when the children ask, you know, you and dad are separating or you divorced and what is the reason for this? And this is an opportunity for you to either, you know, just say what it is because you want to maintain a close and open relationship with your children, because ideally you'd want them to be, you know, come to you with things as well. But it's also that keeping in mind that while I have an open relationship with my children and I want to share with them and I don't want to hide anything from them, but I'll tell them just as much as they need mm-hmm. to know, which is age appropriate, which is not going to be causing them harm. More than that, what they need to know, I will need the assistance of a counselor, of a therapist, or even just consult with one to say, hey, how do I, you know, give me a script of how do I talk to my children in a way that's not going to affect them.
Mm-hmm. Great answer. Thank you so much for that. Turning our attentions to younger children now, an anonymous message saying, her friend's husband shouts at her in front of the kids. And her six-year-old now tells her, if you don't do what I want, I'll tell dad and you know what he will do to you. How can she reverse that image of her in front of her kids and gain respect back? Because the husband won't stop the attitude. That's really difficult. We were talking earlier about really how to undo some, you know, some words or actions and change a perspective that a child might have. Any insights there? Because six is really young to have that.
Absolutely.
That attitude, that opinion of parents in both senses.
Yes, definitely. Children are so, so intelligent. We don't give them enough credit of how clever mm-hmm. they actually are. And ironically, this isn't parental alienation. This goes under model behavior. So children see how one parent treats another parent, and that's what they absorb. So they're like, it's similar to when they want something. Dad says no, mom says yes. So if I don't get what I want, I know I should go to dad. I'll tell dad, if you say no, I'm going to go and ask mom. So it's just children using their way. So how to overcome something like this? One is to be able to seize in whichever way you can. You know, if you are having an argument with a husband, you need to say, we need to, you know, take this behind closed doors. I'm going to walk away, disengage, don't allow this to continue. So that would be the first thing, to stop that. And the second thing is to be able to sit down. You know, I love this book. Dr. Daniel Siegel, he's a child psychiatrist. And one of the things which he uses is connect and redirect with your children. But that's more in behavior. But I think you can use this with anything. Connect with the child and say, mommy, or, you know, mommy is really, you know, surprised by what you said. Can you tell me, what do you mean? Or, you know, just find a way to connect with them. Give them a hug and say, sometimes we say hurtful things and it hurts. So, for example, like you saying that daddy's going to do that. Whatever's between daddy and I is between daddy and I. And for you to say that is not really appropriate. And it makes mommy feel hurt. Or, you know, you try and find, you know your child best. So you'll know how to navigate that conversation.
Now, lastly, because we're running out of time, unfortunately, and as I said, we had a lot of messages on the topic of parental alienation today. For anyone that is going through this, who worries that their partner or ex-partner is trying to manipulate their children, is saying truths or untruths to turn them against them, how can you? Is it ever worth speaking to that partner direct and say, I understand this is what you're doing and I know you might have motivations to do it? Or is that going to be a no-go?
It will depend on whether, if it's a divorce case, then you're pretty much telling them how to hurt you. Mm-hmm. And they would just, you're just giving them more ammunition, and they would, it's not something, because they don't, their aim is to actually destroy you and destroy the relationship that you have with the children. If you are a couple within the same home, it is something that you definitely need to sit down and have a serious conversation about and say that this is affecting my relationship with the children and ultimately going to affect my relationship with you, because, you know, this is how it's going to be. If in the former case, you should have like an intervention where you talk to members of the family and you make the person or the parent who's causing the parental alienation see it from a different perspective, from people who they respect and they look up to, not to see the damage that they're causing to their partner, but the damage that it's causing to their children, present and future.
Thank you so much, Fatima, for your time today. At Aliven, you work with children on counselling, you work with parents and families. What's the best way of getting in touch with you if anything today has resonated, or indeed someone's looking for a bit of support in the family?
You can contact us through our website, and we've got free consultations booking that you can make through the website itself. And our website is www.enlivengroup.co. Yeah.
If you want those details, do feel free to message me on 4001. I'd be happy to share the website. Fatima, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate your honesty, your insights, and of course, taking the questions on the text line too. It's Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer. We are talking children's health, parenting, education this afternoon. Really interesting, just talking there about parental alienation, coercive control, manipulation. And thank you for Meta saying, Armie Hammer's aunt is making a documentary about the cycle of violence passed down. And I think that's such an interesting point. You know, it's not just about what's happening in your family today. It's the impact it can have on your kids, their trust issues, their relationships in the future. So do feel free to reach out if you would like Fatima Abdullah's details. It's Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
I find the topic of parental burnout a really interesting one, because it is nothing new, but I feel like a lot of people are talking about it right now. In fact, one of my favourite podcasts, I turned it on Tuesday morning. It's called Parenting Hell. It's got two UK comedians called Rob Beckett and Josh Widdicombe, and they'd missed two episodes. And I thought it was a bit strange, and I was refreshing my podcasts. And when I got the podcast on Tuesday, they said, you know, we've missed a couple of episodes. One, because of a tech problem, and two, because one of the co-hosts came on and said really openly, I've overextended myself at work. I've got a one-year-old and a four-year-old. She's starting school. We're not sleeping well. And he's like, I just felt overwhelmed, didn't know how to deal with it. And it just felt too much. And my first thought was, wow, how fantastic for two men in their 30s to be really open about that. And then the more people I speak to at the minute who are feeling overwhelmed with work and parental pressures and back to school admin and us, I think, you know, my kind of age group, that kind of 40s, in that kind of sandwich generation of worrying about their kids, but also worrying about their parents. And, you know, as I said, parental burnout is nothing new. You know, throughout history, mums and dads everywhere have experienced stress and anxiety associated with parenting. You know, are we doing it well enough? Am I enough? And it's overwhelming. Plus, add in COVID, you know. So a new study out of the Ohio State University found that 66% of working parents meet the criteria for parental burnout. So and this left unchecked can be associated with depression, anxiety, increased alcohol and substance consumption, and even punitive parenting practices. So we're exploring this afternoon with Jasmine Navarro. She is an expert in family and youth coaching and is also the author of a creative confidence program. Jasmine, thank you so much for being with us. Is it just me and my friends who are experiencing this? How common is parental burnout at the moment, do you think?
First of all, I just want to say, yeah, thank you so much, Helen,
you're
for having
welcome.
Me on. And no, you're absolutely right. It is so common. It is so common. And, you know, I work with parents and I'm hearing this more and more. And of course, it's not just parents, but we're focusing on parents today. And it's real. It's real. Parental burnout is real.
Well, it's interesting. We had a psychiatrist on the show on Tuesday, yeah. And he'd only been in Dubai 8 weeks. And, you know, when we're off air, I was like, all right, come on, tell me the goss. You know, what can we talk about off the radio? And I was like, you know, you've only been here 8 months. What's your read on Dubai's mental health right now? And he was like, burnout. He said, I've never seen anything like it. People coming to him completely overwhelmed. And he was talking more in a professional capacity. But as we're saying, it's definitely extending to the parents as well. We're going to be exploring this topic and, of course, taking your questions. But Jasmine, can I ask you, how and why did you decide to become a family coach? Why is this an area that you're particularly drawn to and really wanted to help people with?
I think for me, because when I was a teenager, I went through my own traumatic grief myself. And my mum's absolutely amazing, but she didn't know what to do. You know, she just didn't know what to do. So I found peace in just leaving the UK and just going off, becoming a teacher. And I ended up living and working in like 11 countries. And that's how I processed my grief. And then, you know, I came to Dubai as a teacher. And that's when I, you know, managed to stop and look back and reflect on my life. And it was like 17 years, 11 countries. You know, I don't want to do this anymore. And then I found coaching, actually. I just kept meeting coaches. So I thought, you know, I'm going to explore this. I'll be coached myself to find out what I want to do with my life. Mm. And during the whole process, it was really powerful, you know, and I learned, you know, you have to work on yourself rather than outside of yourself, like I was doing, going to different countries each time, hoping things would get better. So I started coaching teenagers. And then during that time, I realized, you know, what about the parents? You know, everything starts at home. And if a teenager is suffering, maybe, then probably the parents are as well, and maybe the siblings. So I thought it's a whole family situation. And, you know, then I look back on my mum as well and if she'd have had the right help and support. So I just thought it's every member of the family is affected if something happens.
It really is. And because even if a teenager is going to their parents, and they've got a great relationship with
yes.
them and they can talk to them about,
yes.
you know, anything from, you know, bullying, academics,
yeah.
self-harm, friendships, you know, romance. Even if they're going to their parents, they've got that open dialogue. If a parent doesn't know what to do with it,
exactly.
then things can't be resolved, you know, and I think you're absolutely right. It needs to be that bigger picture. And that might mean being together as a family, talking to an expert, or separately and being able to support each other in different ways. I think that's just got goosebumps. That's really, yeah. Really interesting to hear. And what are families coming to you with at the moment? What issues or,
you know, it's
problems?
Just, I think there's a lot, but, you know, the main ones is just, you know, extreme tiredness, overwhelm. You know, obviously they think, you know, there's not enough hours in the day. But it's just coping with life in general, you know, the basic things in life, you know. And I guess also here, you know, you have the expat lifestyle. So, mm-hmm. you know, maybe you don't have a support network here. So maybe they're on their own. They don't have the family and friends to help out with the children as well. And the recent one that I've had this week, actually, is, you know, lots of parents, families have gone back to their home country for the holiday. But of course, they haven't actually had a holiday.
Mm-hmm.
They've been running around, maybe looking after the parents.
You are about the 20th person to say this to me this week, saying,
really?
It was
yeah.
lovely to go back, but that wasn't a holiday and we're not going to do that again.
Yes, yes, yes. Exactly. They don't rest.
Mm-hmm.
There's no rest. So they're exhausted after the holiday.
A lot of people saying that wasn't a holiday. That was a relocation with less help than we normally have and have come back
yes.
wrecked. Let's talk symptoms. I don't like that kind of, it sounds very medical.
It does.
But
it does.
I guess some of the red flags that we might be able to notice in ourselves, a partner or even a friend.
Yeah, I mean, symptoms can start from, you know, having brain fog, you know, not being able to concentrate on things.
This is where I tick them off on my hand. Yeah, keep going.
And, you know, feeling, you know, mild anxiety, depression as well. You know, it's quite similar as well, the symptoms from depression to burnout. And maybe more severe could be, you know, just crying for no reason, just bursting out crying, you know, losing interest, motivation in doing things, and just feel it like the more severe and, you know, just feeling like you just can't carry on. You just can't carry on.
I read the kind of, I guess, the typical list that, you know, a doctor would put together, and it felt quite unrelatable. It, you know, is a persistent, disruptive, overwhelming exhaustion as a parent, comparisons, emotionally distancing from children. And I was thinking, well, you know, in real life, what, like, you know, as you say, what would that look like? Yeah, bursting into tears.
Yeah.
Being tired, being irritable with your partner, being, I know when I felt overwhelmed, you can't help but lash out with the ones you love the most. You know, with kids, when I'm feeling well rested and balanced, I've got so much more patience with them. And when I'm not, I can snap and I look back and go, that wasn't about them asking me for another snack. That was a whole other thing going on that's triggered that. You know, those negative interactions with your kids and just wanting to get out, I think. And as I said earlier, you know, you can't stop being a parent. You know, it's not like overwhelm at work where they might put you on, leave for stress leave, or you think about moving or a sabbatical, or, you know, you can't. You're with these kids. I wanted to ask, I was curious if this was going to come up. Social media, what role do you think that plays when it comes to contributing to these ideas, these comparisons, this ideals, I guess?
I think definitely it's a huge influence, I mean, you know, especially if you're comparing, you know, if you're a parent and you're comparing maybe your child to somebody else's child, you know, they've, you know, all the activities and classes that they're doing, extra activities, and then, you know, yeah, comparison. I think that can be really quite dangerous. You know, I think social media can be dangerous for everybody, but the comparison,
these little freshly scrubbed, clean cherubs.
Yes, exactly.
That people post on social media rather than my grubby lot.
Yeah.
I wanted to go to the text line. Really great point from Leah. Leah, I think you're my spirit animal. Leah says, I find lowering standards helps a lot. You have to give yourself permission to be a good enough parent and not a superhero. So well said.
I think that's absolutely brilliant. And exactly, that's exactly it. You know, we're somehow taught that being busy is actually a good thing.
Massive, massive specialization of busyness, because that means you're in demand. You're successful. You're juggling.
Exactly. Like, I remember when I was like super busy, like about a year ago, and it was just, it was really hard to cope. And every time I said to somebody, you know, I'm so busy, everybody would say, that's amazing, that's great. And I was just like, no, it's not great.
God, I'm struggling to keep my head above water.
Yes. But it was interesting. Everybody thought it was a good thing.
But then everyone I speak to now, I'm like, how are you? Like, frantic, absolutely frantic. Because we lead really busy lives here in Dubai. We do. Yeah. I mean, you know, forgive me, I don't know, because I've been here 15 years and I've only ever been here as a parent. I don't know what it's like to be a working parent in any other part of the world. I'm pretty sure it's busy everywhere, but
I think so.
Here, I mean, you mentioned after school activities there, you know, social life, work, kids, exercise, you know, self-care, make time for you, make time for your friends. Like, well, I haven't, you know, not Beyonce, I haven't got 100 hours in the day.
Right.
Now, a really interesting point from JP here saying, I was lucky enough to have a health coach referral when I burnt out at work. And his order of tackling things was sleep.
Yeah.
It's so fundamental for our ability to do everything else. Nutrition for gut health. Exercise, indulgence in hobbies. The key was build a routine about prioritizing these things and don't let any of them get out of whack for the sake of others. This was work-related, but I'm sure it could help parents too. I love that. Thanks, JP. We are going to be talking about some techniques, some strategies for, if not preventing, because it might be too late, but maybe helping you work through burnout and get through to the other side. If you do want to share any questions or concerns from your side, or as JP and Leah have been in touch, sharing your insights on what has worked for you, we'd love to hear from you. You don't need to put your name on this here if you would prefer not to. I know we're talking about personal and private things. Anonymity is important. So just get in touch with anything that's on your mind. Nikki, our lovely Scottish soul sister, has been in touch saying, parental burnout, redefine what success is to you, not what everyone expects of you. Pepper your day with wee things that uplift you and be aware of what they are. Well said, Nikki. This is me and my word puzzle every morning. Jasmine, what would you say to that?
Well, exactly. I completely agree. It's, well, first of all, you have to put your own oxygen mask on first. You know, you have to practice self-care every single day. And it's not about, you know, changing everything and doing the big things. It's really the small, consistent things, you know, spending 5 to 10 minutes a day, you know, doing something that you enjoy. What do I really want to do right now? Water the plants, word puzzle, crosswords, stretching, take a walk. You know, it's these simple, simple things.
See, we hear self-care and I'm like, I haven't got time to do 2 hours getting a manicure and a blow dry.
Yes.
I'd be stressing about what I should be during that time. So you think more the bite size.
Definitely the bite size, and do this every single day. You know, everybody can spend 5 to 10 minutes a day. Everybody has that. Mm. And even if you just sit there and you breathe,
please,
you know,
please keep breathing.
Yeah, just breathe. You know, it's not about the big things. It's the small, consistent things that will have a huge impact on your life.
When it comes to coaching parents who might be feeling overwhelmed, and we have had a number of messages that we're going to get to, how do you start to break down where the problem lies?
I think, you know, like with everything, awareness is the first step. So normally, what I normally do with parents is I say, right, they might not want to because it's quite overwhelming as well, but write down everything you have to do this month. Write it all down.
I feel nauseous.
A list. Yeah, yeah. Write the list. A month, every month. I mean, what you have to do every month, week and day. Write it all down. Once it's all written down, yeah, you might feel overwhelmed. And then I might say, you know, how do you feel looking at this list? And then it's like, okay, so do you need to do every single thing on that list? Mm-hmm. You know, what would happen if you could just eliminate some of those things? And of course, you don't have to. There's always some things that can be taken away. You know, it's not life or death situations. You know, you can take things away. And even if you just take things away temporarily until you get your energy back, you know, you don't have to do everything. And if you're running around, you know, taking your children to different activities, maybe, you know, ask yourself this question: what would my child benefit more from? A well-rested parent or this extra activity? Mm-hmm. You know, what's more important? Mm-hmm. You can take some things away, and it's okay not to do everything.
I think that it's, you know, we talk about parental guilt a lot.
Yes.
And I think this is very much tied up with burnout, the pressure we put on ourselves.
Yes.
We talked about social media. Let people do their own thing. Stay on your mat. If there's someone that you're following that makes you feel rubbish, unfollow them. But the guilt that we might get from that perceived comparison,
yeah,
or the guilt that we're, you know, the pressure we're putting on ourselves to, I mean, goodness, as Leah says, lower your standards. I'm trying. I think a good enough parent, done is better than perfect.
Exactly.
Is a big mantra for me. Let's go to the text line. A message here saying, please, can you connect me with your coach? I'm on the edge. My youngest child is going away for conscription service. He's led a really sheltered life and I'm worried how he'll cope. I'm snapping at the kids. I'm crying when I'm alone. He seems really excited to go and has all the information on how to cope, but I still worry as a mother.
Wow. First of all, I want to say, you know, thank you so much for being brave and vulnerable and, you know, for asking for help, because that's actually another thing that we need to do is ask for help, you know. Probably when you ask for help, you'll realize that so many other people are suffering as well. And that's the next thing, you know, you're not alone. And I think it's great that you have this awareness. Mm-hmm. You know, awareness is the first step and things will get better. And I think, yeah, maybe now it's time to seek help, mm-hmm, professional help.
I'll connect you guys separately.
Thanks,
Jasmine. And a message here is saying, thank you for this. I find myself feeling really overwhelmed and not enjoying things. It's been going on for a while, but it's feeling really bad right now. My son is 2. I love him to pieces, but he's so full on at the minute. Very active, up at the crack of dawn. Generally fairly well behaved, to be fair to him, but it is just relentless. He's constantly on the go. Not a question as such, but I can tell you, you're far from alone in that. So that is a really tricky age. I shouldn't say this because, I mean, I love my children dearly, but that 18 month to 2.5 is so hard because they're active, and but they don't listen.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, mine would be running towards escalators and they would think it was just the most hilarious thing in the world just to run away from me. And I was like, no, like, you know, just constantly on edge, constantly. And when we're in that kind of anxious fight or flight, everything can feel like overwhelm. Everything just layers and layers and layers on top. Saying, you know, how can you get a break from this? You know,
think what another thing that I normally like advise parents as well is like, you know, having like the right support, like friends, having friends who have children the same age, you know, you can take turns. Mm-hmm. You can say, "Mate, I'll look after your child today for a couple of hours if you can do the same for me tomorrow."
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah, share.
Could not agree more. That is a really, really great one. Because yeah. Kids are often even better behaved when they're with their friends and they're occupied. They've got a buddy.
That's
they're
true.
Not kind of hanging around looking to be entertained or making mischief or being bored or asking for snacks. If they've got a friend, great. Here's an activity. Watch some TV. Again, lower the standard. A bit of screen time, if you all need a bit of a break, is not the end of the world. It really isn't. And then, as you say, that's going to allow the other parent to, and maybe it is tick off some things on the admin list. Maybe it is tackle that to-do list, because even doing that can feel, to my mind, in a weird way, a bit like self-care, because then you're not worrying about doing things. What about the catastrophizing? Because that's something a lot of parents seem to worry about. If my child isn't learning coding by age 6, then, you know, he's going to be destitute because he's not going to be employable when he's, you know, 22. We allow ourselves to kind of spin out
yes.
on some of these things as well. How can we help ourselves work through that?
I think every day as well. So like spending 5 to 10 minutes every day on self-care, but also spending every day, you know, being reflective, like asking yourself some like key questions. You know, what kind of parent do I want to become? Mm-hmm. You know, who do I want to become? Is my life going in the direction? Am I doing the things
my life? What if those reflective yeah. questions end up you saying no and crying every day?
Well, that's okay. And, you know, that's okay to cry. You know, it's perfectly okay to feel these emotions. And but maybe, yeah, you might cry for a while, but then you will have an answer mm-hmm. afterwards. It's just most of us avoid these feelings.
Totally. We're so quick to distract ourselves.
Yes, yes.
Now, more practical tips. I love JP's point about sleep. And this one kind of resonated with me because most parents I know, I mean, I get home at, you know, 6 o'clock, absolutely wrecked. And then have this burst of energy at around 10 o'clock and decide to stay up watching rubbish until, you know, who knows when. But that's because as parents, we're trying to grasp some time for ourselves. You know, we might be working and spending, you know, our time on someone else's time. We might be with our kids all day. And in the evening is when you think, okay, I can be me now. I can relax a bit. I can watch something mindless. Then in the morning, like, why did I stay up until 11:45 watching absolute garbage with people that I don't even know their names? I don't care who they are, but it just kind of occupied my mind. So good sleep hygiene, helpful?
Definitely, definitely. Sleep is, I mean, if you haven't had a good night's sleep, you know.
Everything seems worse.
Exactly. Everything seems worse. You're more overwhelmed. You probably won't do the tasks as quickly as you would normally, as you won't be as productive. So yeah, sleep. Well, it is the basic things, you know, sleep, eating well and exercise. You know, we have to do all of these things, but nutrition is huge.
For anyone that is feeling overwhelmed right now, and this lady that has been in touch, I presume it's a lady, saying just feeling overwhelmed, you know, just it's relentless. What would be your first port of call? And I would love to say, you know, go and see you and see a coach and make that time. But for some people, that time just isn't possible. What do you think is practical, you know, achievable right now?
Well, I think definitely just stopping for 5 to 10 minutes, because so many people think, I don't have 5 to 10 minutes. You know, I haven't got time, and they don't even stop. So just simply just stopping for 5 to 10 minutes, breathing and just asking yourself, you know, what do I really need right now? And listen, you'll get an answer. Like you always get an answer first, and then you can see what other emotions come up. And whatever emotions come up, it's okay. You know, don't judge your emotions. It's so easy to do. And write a list. Mm-hmm. You know, these things, all of that can take 10 minutes. It's a start.
Speaking of writing lists, I've got one on my phone, which I'm not going to share with you in full, which is things that cheer me up when I'm feeling a bit overwhelmed or sad.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not going to share the full thing, but let's just say watching things like Lip Sync Battle on YouTube, love it.
Having
a quick, you know, sitting outside in the sun for 5 minutes, a word puzzle, like all these little kind of go-tos.
Yes,
but
yes.
When you're feeling overwhelmed, you forget what actually helps. So get a little list on your phone, maybe even include some links to tracks on YouTube or tracks on Calm app, or, you know,
yes,
something
yes.
that you can just have a go-to that feels immediate.
Brilliant. And I think, yeah, and do it, make a promise to yourself to do it every single day and watch your life change. If you do, if you spend 5 minutes with yourself every day doing something that you love, watch your life change.
And your relationship with your kids change as well.
Everything.
Thank you so much. I'm going to connect you with this listener that's been in touch. But if anyone that does want to contact you, and as I said earlier, you do a lot around youth and teen coaching, but also whole family coaching. And that can be specific to a particular circumstance or situation, or it could be just needing some help navigating through that family dynamic.
Exactly.
What's the best way of reaching out?
I guess on my Instagram, with Narva. They can just message me there.
If you want those that link, by all means, message me and I will send it over to you, 4001, or use the WhatsApp. Thank you so much for your time. Really important topic. And thank you for everyone for getting in touch. Deep breaths, folks. And if not, scream into a pillow.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We've spoken a lot over the last couple of months about the impact of the pandemic on the early years education. And really kind of extending this now around sensory development, or indeed experience a lack of sensory development children, increasingly common as a result of COVID-19. Tell us why, and to address this issue is Monica Volarani. She's a Montessori directress and the CEO of Lady Bird Nursery. They've opened their third branch today and the little ones are coming through the door. Some happy parents out there, Monica.
Yes, thank you, Helen.
I am one of those happy parents. Get back to school, girls. And it's been a great week. I think a lot of parents have felt really ready to release them into the wild, get some sense of routine back. But there can be anxieties around whether there's a formal diagnosis or perhaps concerns around sensory, because when you're with your kids, you can look at that behaviour, you can make adjustments. And when they go through the doors of a nursery or school, trying to communicate what those needs might be to someone that you don't really know very well can feel a bit intimidating. So we're hopefully breaking down some of those barriers today. But let's start with the basics. To the best of your understanding, you know, as an education expert and one who's around children an awful lot, what is sensory processing disorder, or SPD as it's commonly known?
Right. So sensory processing disorder is basically when your brain kind of has a traffic jam, in simpler terms, where they're not able to process the signals that are coming through their senses. So that can impair cognitive growth. But there are a lot of sensory activities and ideas that we can work with children.
Can you give us some examples? Because I think that's what, you know, having read about it, and I've got a lot of friends actually whose children, and even they have some sensory processing disorders. What can it actually look like in reality for children?
So children can be hypersensitive or hyposensitive. So some may not like loud noises, or some may have difficulty with spatial awareness. Some are picky eaters. Some have difficulty in communication. Some throw tantrums. So it can be manifested in different ways, mm-hmm. As I say. But there are different therapies, really, to focus and work on all the ideas.
We're going to explore this on a different show with psychologists and neurological experts. But today, because it is back to school, and I think hopefully putting some minds at ease, how can teachers and TAs support children and indeed families when it comes to SPD, Monica?
Well, at our nursery, at Lady Bird Nursery, our curriculum, so we have the EYFS curriculum in a Montessori setting. And the Montessori setting itself is based on sensory work. So we actually have a part of the curriculum, which is a sensorial area. So that actually has material to develop your senses. So we have smelling bottles, we have thermic tablets, we have touch fabrics. So we've got a variety of materials that children that are didactic. So children are actually working through them, and it's kind of play to them. But at the same time, they're refining all their senses, their motor skills, their language, social skills.
You mentioned there that, you know, sometimes this traffic jam can result in tantrums and perhaps inability to emotionally regulate. How does that work in a classroom environment with staff being able to accommodate that and help those kids with learning in the way that's going to best benefit them?
Well, once we know the children that need that additional support, we've actually already worked with our parents and all our branches have an inclusion, head of inclusion. So we work with our teachers and parents to come up with a what you call a sensory diet, really, which isn't a diet in the true form. But maybe a child may need to leave the classroom for 10 minutes to run around or to go for a walk. So those are the things we already know about the child. So when they come to us, we have a plan for them. Mm-hmm. So we're prepared as to how to engage the child and really what sensory experiences that they need.
I think it can be a bit of a tricky one because some parents are keen to seek a kind of a formal diagnosis. And some, especially if it's your first child, you might not have any frame of reference. And it's only when they come to a nursery or school environment, it might be a teacher or TA says, just want to flag something. This is what we've experienced. What's it like trying to have a conversation like that as an educator with a parent that might not want to hear it?
We're very careful about that. I mean, we go through the process internally first. So as I said, so our teacher, our principal, our inclusion coordinator would all first agree that there might be an issue. And then we would gently, obviously, work with the parent. I mean, we would not say that this is what we think it is. Or we would just say, hey, these are the things we've noticed. And have you noticed it at home? And maybe just keep an eye and sort of move forward that way.
I think to imagine this conversation happening, you know, certainly 10 years ago, I don't think it would be happening. I think an awful lot of children just would be very quickly dismissed as being naughty or disruptive. Yeah. What's it been like to see some of these conversations happening within the education space around inclusion?
It's been hard. I mean, I think parents still find it difficult because, like you said, in our days, we didn't even know what it was.
I think back to classmates, I'm like, well, exactly. He definitely had something, you know, that should have been, you know, addressed and
That's
helped
right.
with.
I think there's just so much information now on everything that even something like this is, it can be a tough conversation, but I think parents are pretty good now. They're on board. They want to help.
Speaking to us now is a mum of three. Krishma Shah has taught in a nursery, and we're talking about some of the benefits of sensory play to help overcome and even prevent SPD. Krishma, thank you so much for being with us today. Can you tell us a little bit about your family? How old are the kids?
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
I've got three daughters. The eldest one is 5, and then the middle one is 3, and the youngest one is 2. So
wow.
It's quite busy.
You're in the trenches, Karishma.
<Yeah.
laughs> Well, thank you for making the time today. Tell us a little bit about your own experience as a family with sensory processing disorder.
Well, so actually one of my daughters is really sensitive to loud noises and is quite averse to certain textures of foods, like touching them. She's even quite like, If it comes to a certain texture of a rug or a carpet, she'll be a bit iffy to step on it. So sensory play is something that we do a lot to help her kind of overcome this.
Can you break this down for us? Because when I think of sensory play, I go straight to shaving foam and plastic dinosaurs. And tell us a little bit about things that you were doing at the nursery. And also, you know, for people listening today whose kids either aren't at nursery or they want to be offering a little bit of play at home in this in this space, what are some of the bits of kit and how do you believe it can really benefit?
So, I mean, whether it be even homemade Play-Doh or like oobleck is basically corn flour and water.
I love oobleck. We made it last week.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's a non-Newtonian fluid.
Yes, it's amazing to touch and feel. And like it just helps children and even adults just process information and kind of just work through their feelings towards senses.
The way Monica described it,
it doesn't have to be messy either.
Okay.
It can even just be like dry textures like rice or in Ladybird we have specific Montessori materials that enhance senses as well, that focus on colors, shapes, textures like fabrics. So it doesn't necessarily have to be too messy if the child is not into that, because I know a lot of children try to avoid mess.
Well, that's an interesting point because we've seen more and more anecdotal stories, and I don't think there's been any studies on it to the best of my knowledge, around cleanliness, around, you know, the pandemic and not wanting to feel dirty. And obviously we've had this huge emphasis on washing hands as well. So If that is the case, definitely worth speaking to an expert. And anything, if you are of course seeking a diagnosis, do not go to Google. Go and speak to please. Yeah. It's like a kind of a neuro expert in the pediatrician space. So some good bits to have at home then, some dry materials, and that can be dry rice, oobleck.
Yeah, I love like these, even colored chickpeas, or even just have a tub of water with like floating or sinking equipment, like pom-poms, and just different objects in the water. And it can be as simple as that. And if they're highly sensitive to a specific scent, like texture, then maybe introduce this in short bursts, mm-hmm. as opposed to like throwing them in the deep end, mm-hmm. with like oobleck. just introduce it slowly, and then they get used to it, and then they kind of, if they keep their hands busy with it, it helps them kind of breathe through their kind of fear of touching, as it would be with any other sense as well.
And blocking that traffic jam. Krishma, thank you. Yeah. Really do appreciate it. Lovely to have you with us, and all the very best to you and the girls. Monica, for anyone that is worried about having a conversation with a new teacher or TA about, we're talking about sensory processing disorder, but indeed anything, how do you recommend you start to have that conversation?
Well, firstly, when you enroll your child at Ladybird, we have a form that we give out before they join us called Getting to Know You form. So we ask our parents to give us as much information about their child, even if there's a certain way they say they want to use the toilet, or they want water or food. So we get the first set of information even before they've walked in the door. So that's really, comforting, I think. And then we have an open door policy. So at any time, a parent is can reach out to the teacher or the principal to have a conversation. And we gradually just hopefully allow them to feel comfortable enough to come to us and work with them.
And that's exactly it. You've found somewhere that feels like home, that feels like a good match for you and your family when those conversations hopefully feel easy. Thank you so, so much, Monica. Really do appreciate your time. We have had a number of questions on this. As I said, we're definitely going to revisit this sensory processing disorder in children and in adults, because we've had a couple of messages talking about sounds being triggering for grown-ups too. So make sure you stay with us. Don't forget, we talk health on Tuesdays and on Thursdays about children, parenting, education, and more.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're talking education, higher education, and beyond. Joining me in the studio now is Saba Vaziri. She's going into her last year of law school in just a few weeks, the London School of Economics. And she's in the studio telling us a little bit about being a student during COVID and what life is going to be like once you leave university. Thank you for making the time to be with us, Saba. Now, you grew up here in Dubai. You're a student here, got amazing results, which has put you on that path at LSE. What is it about law that really kind of caught your imagination or attentions?
Hi, Helen. First, I'd like to say thank you so much for having me on. It's
you
a pleasure to be
very
here.
Very welcome.
I get asked this question quite a lot, actually, and I feel like every time I answer it quite differently, but I think the main kind of thing is I've always loved helping people and solving problems and issues and things like that. And I really do believe that adequate legal representation in society is a human right. Mm-hmm. And kind of knowing that growing up and really kind of thinking about that, and in addition to kind of loving solving people's problems, really made me want to go into a career for law. I mean, helping people, solving their problems and giving them adequate legal representation is a fascinating thing to do as a career.
Is there an aspect or area of law that you're particularly interested in?
Well, I'm quite interested in a variety of law, but I mean, I think I'm going to go into commercial corporate law. In particular, I'm really interested in projects, energy and construction work. And there is quite a there are quite less females in that kind of industry,
yeah,
especially
go fly the flag,
especially
Saba.
In the Middle East. Yeah. So I would love to qualify into construction and energy and projects. But I think in the future, I really love getting involved with pro bono work as well. The human rights aspect to it, the kind of human element of law. So I think alongside my kind of corporate commercial construction career, I would be getting involved and continuing to get involved in a lot of pro bono work for people who can't particularly afford adequate legal representation. education. I mean, in London right now, I'm currently working with Citizens Advice to do that. So I'm hoping in the future to continue and carry on doing my pro bono work.
So you're doing this on the side of studying to be a lawyer. I was doing nothing on the side of studying to be a journalist. I'll tell you that. I was having a great old time. I got a 2-2 and totally deserved it. Sava, tell us about being a student over the last couple of years, because you went to London really just before things really kicked off and changed forever. Tell us about the timing and what that actually looked like for you.
Yeah, so it was definitely an interesting time. I mean, COVID hit in my last year of school, so in year 13, mm-hmm. College, and I ended up not sitting my A-levels in person, which I think it was a blessing in disguise, to be honest.
Well, we had the A-level results come out a couple of weeks ago, and we're going, it's been a big dip since the last couple of years, and the students who'd already got the results a few years ago, we don't care.
Yeah.
But you got, listen, you're obviously an incredibly intelligent girl, and your teachers obviously knew you very well, and you got great results, and that's what we're going to leave it as, because they are there and never will be changed. But that obviously must have been a big shakeup when it came to thinking about what that university experience was going to look like.
Definitely. I mean, I didn't even know if I was going to go to London in the summer because things were just so uncertain. But I did end up going in September of 2020 for a very long period of 6 weeks.
Oh, man.
Before lockdown in the UK happened and everyone that was kind of international, which is another interesting thing about London is that it's so diverse and international. I feel like it wasn't too much of a big jump, given that a lot of my friends from school did move to London. Mm-hmm. So there was kind of a community of us that were international, went to school in Dubai, grew up in Dubai, that were in the same position. So I couldn't say I was completely alone. But yeah, after those 6 weeks, I did end up moving back to Dubai and did the first year of law school completely online, along with my first year exams, which were 24 hours.
That's not the student experience. I know we go to university for an education and the academic side, but we also go to, you know, make friends and make mistakes and, you know, get to know a new city and all of that. You must have felt like that was taken away from you, but thankfully things have corrected somewhat now.
Yeah, I feel like the silver lining to the kind of online university is that even though you don't get the kind of typical uni experience in person, you do have so much more flexibility as well. Like, I was able to do so many of my hobbies from Dubai and kind of be at home, obviously not spend as much money on accommodation in London. And I think that is a silver lining to all of this. Mm-hmm. But I will say that in second year, when I did move to London full time, I really did see the difference. And I feel like when you don't know what it's like going to uni in person, you don't really know what you're missing out on.
Yeah.
So when I did move this year, I was really like, oh my gosh, I did really miss the human interaction and kind of the collaborative environment that law students really need to debate issues.
Exactly. That social side, you know, testing your boundaries, seeing where other people stand, their lens from whatever part in the world they've come from. Really interesting question here. No name when they're saying, how did Saba adjust from sheltered life in Dubai to life in a big city? And this is a question that I've actually been thinking about a lot myself over the summer. We went to Lisbon and my kids are really little. They're 5 and 7. But it did make me think about, I guess, expat kids growing up. And we're so lucky here in Dubai in terms of safety. And I've now become conditioned to, you know, leaving my phone, my bag on the back of a chair and, you know, waltzing off to the, you know, the coffee counter. How did you find that adjustment? Or was it perhaps not as extreme as I might be imagining?
Well, I think it is quite a big adjustment. If you've grown up and lived in Dubai, as you said, it is kind of a sheltered life. And we are very, very lucky to live in such a safe and amazing city here. So I think it did take a few months of adjusting. But I really do think that having a good group of friends and that community that you create with the university there, I mean, you have to remember, you're not just going and just living on your own and doing nothing. And you do have that support from your school and university and stuff. So that really did help. But it really does take some adjusting and just kind of being smart and not going out alone after dark and kind of always having a friend with you and just kind of remembering that not everywhere is as amazing as Dubai is, mm-hmm. is really important. But yeah, no, I think it does take some time and adjusting, and it is quite overwhelming to begin with, but everyone soon adapts and
the right
London's
group
amazing.
Around you.
Yeah,
I'm exactly. Really glad you're enjoying London. Do you think you'd come back here, or have you got your sights set on somewhere else after you finished your training contract? What are you thinking?
Well, my training contract is between Dubai and London, so it's 6 months in each. And I do think I will qualify in Dubai because just the sector of energy and projects is just very, very big in the Middle East right now. And, you know, Dubai is always home for me. I was born here. I mean, I love London, but Dubai will always be home. It's where my parents are. And I just think it's just amazing. I mean, I don't know where the future will take me. Mm-hmm. So I'm not closing any doors. But yeah, I think for the near future, I will, after my training contract, qualify as a lawyer in Dubai.
And lastly, for anyone who might be thinking about the what next, they're at university and they're perhaps not on a path like law, where there is quite a clear direction. You get your training contract, you're so many years qualified, and there is that kind of natural ladder. With your friends who you're studying with, or indeed friends who are doing different courses, any advice for thinking about that what do I want question after university?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think, well, the first thing I would say is, if there's a will, there's always a way. That's something I've always kind of, my parents have taught me since growing up. And anything you really want to do and you put your mind to, I mean, you really can achieve. So I think having that inner drive and motivation is really important. But one thing that kind of I see my friends and other degree and disciplines doing is really talking to people with more experience. So go on LinkedIn, message people in the industry you want to go to, ask them for a 5-minute coffee, ask them for a little Zoom call. I'm 100% sure that you will get some responses and people will be more than happy to help. Mm-hmm. So I think just reaching out to people in the industries that you're interested in, even if you don't have a particular industry yet, is really important to kind of gauge whether you would want a career in it.
And even if it's just a case of discounting, that can be useful in
exactly.
itself.
Exactly, elimination.
Exactly. Saba, thank you so, so much. Lovely to have you in the studio. Enjoy London. And we'll see you back in Dubai, well, maybe very soon indeed.
Thank you so
Thank
much for
you.
Having me on.
Really interesting Thank to get the you. Perspective. Saba speaking to us. She's back to LSE very soon. Grew up here in Dubai. If you've got someone in your family, in your life, that wants to share their story, what they've been through, or has some advice or a story to tell, get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.